Masal khair, bonsoir, and good evening. And I hope you will now forgive me if I give my talk in English. Thank you very much for that extremely kind introduction. I must admit it took me just 1 or 2 minutes to realize that you were talking about me. But thank you very much for inviting me here this evening. It is always a great pleasure to come to Lebanon. In fact, I think I recognized some of you from a meeting about 2 years ago at a COPD masterclass, and I think I also met 1 or 2 of you at the beginning of the COPD Inception program 2 years ago. So it's nice to see you again. Some of you will have heard the story I'm about to tell, but for those of you who I've never had the pleasure of meeting before, let me tell you how delighted I am to see you all here this evening for this meeting. And I say this with real feeling, because it reminds me of the time, or to be absolutely honest, it does not remind me of the time, when a colleague of mine was asked to come and talk at a very similar evening symposium. And he turned up at the right venue, the right time, the right date, and there was not a single person in the auditorium to hear his talk. So he waited 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. Eventually one other person came in and predictably sat right at the very back. And my friend said, "It is crazy to give a talk to just one person. Let's forget about it and go out to the bar and have a beer instead." This person said, "No," he said, "I have come a long way. I want to hear your talk." So my friend gave his talk, and at the end, this one person clapped, and then my friend said, "Okay, now let's go outside and have a beer." To which this other person said, "Uh-uh," he said, "now you wait and listen to me. I am the second speaker." So unless you are all second speakers, I'm delighted to see you all here this evening. I've been asked to show you some important clinical trial data and some important information about glycopyrrolium, a new long-acting muscarinic antagonist in a breezhaler called Sebri, which I think has just recently become available in Lebanon. I want to try to convince you that this is now a really good alternative LAMA treatment for patients with COPD. Now, I have to start the talk somewhere, and I suppose these days it is impossible to give any talk on COPD without starting off with, so what does GOLD say about COPD, and what does GOLD recommend? Now, I haven't been at your meeting throughout today. I don't know how many times you may already have seen this diagram. Do not worry, I'm not going to spend any time on it whatsoever.
Thank you.
But it does emphasize the fact that when we are treating people with COPD, increasingly we are trying to treat their symptoms and not just their lung function. And I think that's why when we look at any new treatments for COPD, we have got to look at what symptomatic benefits they bring to our patients. So having not spoken about this diagram at all, we then normally have to move on to this diagram, which again you all know off by heart, and I'm not going to go over it, but I would like to make just 2 points. One is to emphasize that inhaled corticosteroids, ICS, are only recommended for patients who are having more than 2 exacerbations a year and poor lung function. And as we will see, far too many patients who do not need to have inhaled steroids are actually being given them, and I'll show you that in some of the clinical trial data. And I think we have to get back to basics, and now that we have really good long-acting bronchodilator therapy, we really need to spend much more effort optimizing bronchodilator therapy and not necessarily giving patients inhaled steroids when they don't need them. The only real point I want to make from this slide is if we look at LAMA, which is what I'm going to talk about this evening, long-acting muscarinic antagonists, and for all quadrants of the slide, LAMA is either first choice or second choice treatment according to the GOLD strategy. So all patients with COPD irrespective of their symptomatology, irrespective of their lung function, irrespective of their exacerbation history, somewhere or another, LAMA therapy is indeed indicated for their inhalation treatment. So I'm not going to spend any time this evening convincing you that LAMA treatment is good treatment for COPD. But what I do want to do is to make the point that certainly for the past, 10, 12 years, the only LAMA therapy that has been available to us is tiotropium in the hand inhaler, Spiriva. And I think for many of us, over the past 10, 12 years, this has been the gold standard LAMA therapy for people with COPD because there has not been any alternative LAMA therapy available. But now that has all changed, and we now have glycopyrronium in the Breezhaler, Sebree, a new exciting LAMA treatment, which is now an option to use instead of tiotropium. And what I want to do this evening is to show you the data behind glycopyrronium, how it can, the sort of things it can do for our patients, and crucially, how it compares with tiotropium. So that's what I want to do during the course of my presentation. But before that, I just want to emphasize again what I think, perhaps controversy isn't quite the right word, but the conflict we often have, particularly at congresses like this, between what doctors want and what our patients expect. So here we are, here's a doctor and here's a patient. This could be any of you sitting in the audience. And if I were to ask any of you, so why do you come to this annual congress? What do you hope to get out of coming to your annual congress? In the same way I go to the British Congress, lots of people go to European congresses and so on. And by and large, when I ask people this, the answer I usually get is you want to see the most important scientific and clinical trial data about new treatments. And I will disappoint you if I do not show you this data. But here is a patient waiting to see me. He's waiting to see me outside my hospital. Unfortunately, as you can see, he's just having his last cigarette before he comes to see me, so he's a real genuine patient. He knows that I'm coming to this congress. What is he thinking? If I say I'm going to be talking about a new treatment for COPD, what does he expect to get out of meetings like this? Well, I think he will say he wants to know that the treatments we're going to use will make him less breathless, enable him to walk further, have a better quality of life, and have fewer exacerbations. He is interested in symptoms. We can add in the early morning symptoms that we heard about just a few minutes ago. So I think for any treatment now, yes, we need to look at clinical trial data and scientific data and pharmacology data and so on, but crucially, I think we also have to focus on what our patients want and what they need to get out of any new treatment for COPD. So, during the course of this presentation, I hope you will agree that what I really need to do is to convince you, for glycopyrronium, I need to show the evidence, what sort of a drug it is, how it compares with tiotropium in terms of basic pharmacology. What does it actually do in lung function in terms of its speed of onset, lasting for 24 hours, and being effective over a long period of time? But crucially, what is it going to do in terms of the symptoms our patients are concerned about? Breathlessness, quality of life, frequency of exacerbations. We all want to know that any new drug we're going to use is safe. We know for many of our patients, what really upsets them more than anything else is not being able to exercise or getting breathless when they exercise. So I need to show you some good exercise data, and crucially, I need to show you some really good head-to-head comparisons with tiotropium, current gold standard treatment, to show you that glycopyrronium is at least as good as tiotropium, if not better, in that it has some added advantages as well. And finally, because now we are increasingly using combination bronchodilator therapy, what is the evidence that if you add glycopyrronium to long-acting beta agonist treatment, you can get the anticipated additive effects that you might expect? So I hope you will agree that is the list of things I need to convince you about. And if I don't convince you on all of these, you should go away dissatisfied. If I do convince you, I hope you will go away very satisfied. But this provides a challenge for me. And the reason it provides a challenge is I'm going to have to go through a fair bit of clinical trial data from what is called the GLOW program. One of the things that always fascinates me with any pharmaceutical company when they do clinical trials is how they decide on the name of the trial. And over the years, you know, we've had Torch, we've had Uplift. Does anyone know what these names actually stand for? Well, I'm going to show you a lot of studies called GLOW studies. And if you want to know what GLOW stands for, it's actually quite easy. There's the G, L, O, and W. So glycopyrronium, COPD, and airways. So that's the GLOW studies I'm going to show to you. But the challenge for me is there's an awful lot of clinical trial data, and the total time I had for my presentation was 45 minutes, which I've already used up a fair amount already. So the challenge is to pick the interesting clinical trial data to illustrate the checklist I gave you and convince you that there is good clinical trial data out there to satisfy all the requirements that I listed within the time available to me. So let's just start off with a little bit of basic pharmacology about what we now all call muscarinic antagonists. When I first qualified, we called them anticholinergics. So in what way is glycopyrronium going to be different from tiotropium? Now, I suspect many of you in the audience know far more pharmacology about the parasympathetic nerve system and cholinergic nerve transmission than I do. But this is just to remind me, rather than anyone else, that what we're talking about is cholinergic tone in airways in people with COPD, and crucially, we're talking about the way acetylcholine produces bronchoconstriction and airway smooth muscle by activating M3 receptor sites. And what we want our muscarinic antagonists to do is to antagonize those M3 receptor sites and reverse cholinergic tone. We know, too, that there are M2 receptor sites at the end of the postganglionic nerve fibers responsible for negative feedback, and we don't really want a muscarinic antagonist to antagonize those M2 receptor sites, but we do want them to preferentially antagonize the M3 receptor sites. In addition, because if they antagonize those M2 receptor sites, you're interfering with negative feedback, and that may actually diminish the bronchodilation you're going to get. But we are also very much aware of the fact that there are M2 receptor sites on cardiac muscle, which again, we don't wish to antagonize those, because if they're antagonized, that may increase heart rate, increase cardiac contractility, and for people with COPD with coexistent cardiac disease, that potentially may be something we don't want to do. So what we want with a long-acting muscarinic antagonist for people with COPD is for it to be very selective for M3 receptors over M2 receptors. So we're looking for M3 versus M2 specificity. If we look at the anticholinergic or muscarinic antagonists we've had in clinical practice in the past, for many, many years we just had the short-acting muscarinic antagonist ipratropium. Tiotropium was developed from ipratropium, and here is glycopyrronium. And the point I want to make is tiotropium was developed from ipratropium, and they therefore have very similar molecular structures with this quaternary ammonium compound. Glycopyrronium is structurally entirely different, and although it's a muscarinic antagonist, it's going to have different properties from ipratropium and tiotropium. And in particular, it is going to show more specificity for the M3 receptor sites than the M2 receptor sites. And this is shown in laboratory experiments, firstly looking at the binding to M3 and M2 receptor sites. And if you look at the selectivity for M3 sites over M2 sites, comparing glycopyrronium and tiotropium, glycopyrronium has much greater M3 versus M2 receptor binding sensitivity. And also, if you look at the rate of dissociation from M2 and M3 receptor sites, glycopyrronium has faster dissociation from M2 versus M3 compared with tiotropium. So it's less likely to antagonize M2 sites, and it's going to go away faster from M2 sites. And these, I think, are two important pharmacological advantages of glycopyrronium over tiotropium. Another important advantage, which I'll show you when we come to the clinical trial data, is compared with tiotropium, it has a faster onset of action in terms of producing bronchodilatation as well. So, can we put a little tick by pharmacology? And I hope in the time available I've said enough about the pharmacology to convince you that glycopyrronium is different from tiotropium and potentially may have extra things to offer. Let's now move on to the clinical trial program and start to look at, perhaps from our point of view, is it really an effective bronchodilator? How does it work? Does it last for a full 24 hours? So we'll start off with the GLOW-1 study. And this was a fairly straightforward study, a 26-week study, parallel group study comparing once daily inhaled glycopyrronium in a Breezhaler compared with inhaled placebo in a Breezhaler in two groups of patients with COPD. This shows the patients, those that received active drug, those that received placebo. And one point I'll make just in passing, and I did allude to this earlier, in this study, and indeed in all the other studies I'm going to show you this evening, if you look at the percentage of patients who were having more than two exacerbations a year, only about 4 or 5% in both groups were having exacerbations more than two a year. But if you look at the percentages that were already on inhaled corticosteroids, over 50% in both groups. And bearing in mind, having more than two exacerbations ought to be the criteria for being on inhaled steroids, already we're seeing from this and from the other studies, probably a lot of patients are being overtreated with inhaled steroids who don't really need them. So, what were the results in these studies? This shows the effects on day one, and I hope you can just about see the placebo there. But as you would expect, there's a large difference between active drug and placebo on day one. And crucially, the glycopyrronium has a very fast onset of action, producing improvements in FEV1 literally within 5 minutes or so, and I'll show you more of that later. This shows the effects at week 12. There's placebo at week 12. There's placebo at week 26. And again, as you would expect, a difference between the two, showing you're getting persistence of this bronchodilator effect over a full 24-hour period. For inhaled bronchodilators that last for 24 hours, the measurement that we often rely on in clinical studies is the trough FEV1 at the end of the 24-hour period, which shows the improvement that's still there before you give the next dose the following day. And you can see comparing glycopyrronium with placebo day 1, week 12, and week 26, good improvements in trough FEV1. So that's what you would expect to see with an effective, once-daily, long-acting bronchodilator. So I hope if we go back to this diagram, we can put two ticks there showing fast onset of action. I'll show you some more data for that later. And also, the bronchodilation does indeed last over a full 24-hour period. The GLOW-2 study took this a little bit further. And in GLOW-2, firstly, the study went on for 1 year, 52 weeks. And in three parallel groups, one group received once-daily glycopyrronium via the Breezhaler. One group received once-daily placebo via the Breezhaler. And a third group received open-label tiotropium. Everyone knew that they were taking tiotropium once a day through the handyhaler. So this wasn't a conventional double-blind study, but of course it's not possible to do that because glycopyrronium comes in a Breezhaler device, tiotropium comes in a handyhaler device. You can't put glycopyrronium into a handyhaler, and you can't put tiotropium into a Breezhaler. So it had to be open label, but there are still very useful results from this study, and I'll show you a much better study later on, which made a much better comparison between glycopyrrolium and tiotropium. But let's look at the results of this study. Again, here are the details of the patients in the glycopyrrolium group, the placebo group, and the open label group. Again, I won't go on and on about this. Very small percentages of patients getting frequent exacerbations, but very large percentages of patients already receiving possibly unnecessary inhaled steroids. What were the results of lung function in this group? So these show the results on day 1, week 12, halfway through the year, and at the end of the year, glycopyrrolium in yellow, tiotropium in green, placebo in grey. And straight away we can see throughout the study, looking at trough FEV1, both glycopyrrolium and tiotropium at all points in the study produced pretty equal amounts of improvement in trough FEV1. Interestingly, at week 26, glycopyrrolium actually produced a statistically significant improvement even compared with tiotropium, but this shows that both drugs are producing long-active bronchodilatation throughout the full 1 year of the study. So we know that these are both effective long-acting bronchodilators. What is interesting is looking at the speed of onset, comparing glycopyrrolium with tiotropium. And this shows on day 1, when the very, very first dose of either drug is being given, there is placebo, here is tiotropium, and here is glycopyrrolium. And again, this shows the faster onset of glycopyrrolium, getting much quicker onset of bronchodilatation, and indeed reaching its maximal value much sooner. And if over the first 4 hours you look at the area under the curve, you can see comparing the area under the curve for tiotropium compared with glycopyrrolium, you've got a statistically significant improvement with the glycopyrrolium. And I think this is crucially important in terms of the morning symptoms that we heard so much about, because we know patients are at their worst first thing in the morning. That's why they often have to use a salbutamol inhaler to get started for the day. We can be confident that if they use glycopyrrolium, they're going to get just as much benefit just as quickly, and that really may help them with these early morning symptoms that often preclude them from getting started for the day. In fact, if you accept that an improvement of 100 mils in FEV1 is probably the minimal clinically significant improvement we're looking for, if you look at the percentage of patients whose FEV1 improves by more than 100 mil within 5 minutes, already something like 42% of glycopyrrolium patients are getting that improvement, and within 15 minutes, over 50%. So with glycopyrrolium, not only is it long-acting, not only do the effects last after weeks and months, but you really do get this fast onset of action, which may be very important for our patients. How about the more patient-focused outcomes? As you know, in clinical studies, the way to assess improvements in breathlessness is to look for changes in the transitional dyspnea index to see if you can improve the TDI. And this shows both at week 26 and at week 52, the improvements in TDI with glycopyrrolium and tiotropium virtually identical with both active drugs and clearly better than placebo. Much the same is seen when we look at the results for health status, quality of life, measured by the St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire, where, if you remember, an improvement in quality of life produces a decrease in the SGRQ score. And here we can see both glycopyrrolium and tiotropium equally effective at week 26 and week 52 and producing significant improvements compared with placebo. So again, glycopyrrolium, tiotropium, equally efficacious in producing improvements in quality of life. And similarly, no difference between the two in terms of their ability to prevent exacerbations. Tiotropium and glycopyrrolium, no significant difference between those two curves, and clearly both of them better than placebo. Safety obviously matters, and these are the adverse events that are monitored in any clinical trial. And if you look at the percentages with which all of these adverse events occur in glycopyrrolium, tiotropium, and placebo, You'll see there are hardly any differences between the three columns for those adverse events or the other commonly monitored adverse events shown on the next slide. So I think we can be reassured about the safety of glycopyrrolium as well. So if I go back to my little checklist, I hope you will agree I've shown you further evidence of speed of onset, that the bronchodilatation lasts for a full 24 hours, and the effects are sustained, certainly in a one-year study. And we also have improvements in TDI, improvements in the St. George's Respiratory Questionnaire, fewer exacerbations, and the drug is safe. So far we've got lots of ticks. Now, I want to go back to that patient I showed you and the sort of things our patients expect to happen. Our patient wants to be able to exercise more and be less breathless. Okay, I've shown you data about the TDI improving, but my patients aren't interested in TDI scores. They just want to know, can I actually do more and will I be less breathless? And the only way we can really find that out one way or another is by doing a properly constructed exercise study. Now, doing exercise studies are obviously very difficult and very time-consuming, but I think of crucial importance is the GLOW3 study. And what this study did, it took a group of patients with COPD, and this was a crossover study, in that after a running period, half the patients received once-daily glycopyrrolium for 21 days, and the other half received inhaled placebo for 21 days. There was then a washout period, and the group that got glycopyrrolium first then had placebo for the next 3 weeks, and the group that had placebo then had glycopyrrolium for the next 3 weeks. On entry into the study, all the patients undertook an incremental exercise test to find out what their maximal exercise capacity was. And from there on, for all subsequent exercise tests, they were exercised to 80% of their maximal capacity. So from there on, they had exercise tests done at eight. They were sub-maximal exercise tests at 80% of their individual maximum. And whether they were on active drug or placebo, the measurement was made of the endurance time, how long they could actually exercise at 80% of maximal exercise capacity, how long could they do that for, and crucially, whether on active drug or placebo, at the same time into their exercise test, how breathless were they, and what was their inspiratory capacity. And these measurements were made for both groups, both on day 1 and on day 21. These are the patients that were put into the study, and here, crucially, are the results. And this shows on the very first day of the study, so after the very, very first dose of glycopyrrolium compared with placebo, you can see already comparing the results in the patients, they were getting an increase in their exercise endurance time of 10%. 10% after the very first dose of the drug. And after 3 weeks, these are the results after 3 weeks comparing the same patients when they were on active drug and placebo. At the end of 3 weeks, their ability to exercise at 80% of their maximal exercise capacity had increased by 21%. So for my patient who says, I want to be able to exercise more, I can say, if you're on this drug compared with placebo, you're going to be able to exercise, do the same sort of exercise for up to 20% longer. So that's really important. What about how breathless the patients there are? So ISO time, the same time into exercise, whether the patients are taking their active drug or placebo, this shows their Borg-Dysk near score, and you can see at ISO time, both on day 1 and on day 21, the patients are doing the same amount of work, but they are much less breathless. And what I think is even more interesting, I think most of us now accept that the reason patients with COPD become breathless in the first place is due to static hyperinflation, which gets worse on exercise with dynamic hyperinflation, because they have a reduced inspiratory capacity. And the way we believe most of our treatments are working now in making patients less breathless, able to exercise more, is by increasing their inspiratory capacity. And I suspect this is probably the most important physiological measurement we should be making on patients with COPD, potentially far more relevant than FEV1. And in this study, doing the spirometry, you can see both on day 1 and on day 21, the inspiratory capacity of the patients taking active drug had increased compared with placebo, and I'm sure it is this increase in inspiratory capacity that enables them to exercise longer with a longer endurance time and be less breathless with a lower Bork score. So in terms of my patient I showed you at the beginning, I can tell him, if you're on this drug, you will be able to do more and you will be less breathless. So, if we go back to my checklist, I hope we can now put a little tick there as well. Now, crucially, how does glycopyrronium really compare with tiotropium? The first GLOW2 study I showed you, remember, was 1 year with patients taking either active glycopyrronium or placebo, but open-label tiotropium. And that's not really satisfactory if you want to do a proper double-blind study. But how can you do that with two entirely separate inhalation devices? Well, the answer was provided by the GLOW5 study, which actually uses a double dummy design. And what that means, this study went on for, it was a 12-week study, and what this study did, all patients finished up taking two inhalers on a double-blind basis. Some patients were taking active glycopyronium in a breathe-haler and placebo tiotropium in a hand-haler. The other patients were taking placebo glycopyronium in a breathe-haler and active tiotropium in the hand-haler. So they were both using one breathe-haler and one hand-haler, but they were only getting one active drug. And I think that's the best way you're going to get a fair comparison between glycopyrronium and tiotropium. So a 12-week study, again, these are the patients. I won't make the boring point about most of them probably being on inhaled steroids when they didn't need to. You're going to get bored if I keep on saying that. But crucially, here are the results. So this shows trough FEV1 at week 12, and in this much better designed study, as you would expect, very similar improvements in trough FEV1 for both glycopyrronium and tiotropium. So what we saw in the earlier study is replicated in this study. If we now look at the speed of onset of day 1, looking at that area under the FEV1 time curve up to 4 hours, you can see looking at day 1, no doubt that glycopyrronium has a faster onset than tiotropium and reaches its maximum more quickly, and that is statistically significant. You're still getting exactly the same fast onset with glycopyrronium 12 weeks later, but as the dose of tiotropium builds up, you're getting a better effect with tiotropium after 12 weeks than day 1, and although there is still a difference between the two groups, it's no longer statistically significant. But again, we can be confident if we want to treat those early morning symptoms, giving glycopyrronium really produces fast improvements in FEV1, which will be helpful for our patients. This shows the improvements in TDI and the improvements in SGRQ in this study. Again, very similar between the two groups, just as you would expect. And this shows, it's a much shorter study, but again shows no difference between the two groups in terms of exacerbations. So, this is not the GLOW study, this is a slightly different study looking at the inhalation devices, comparing the breathe-haler with the hand-haler. And one big difference between the two devices is that breathe-haler has a much lower resistance to airflow, to inspiratory airflow, than the hand-haler. And we know when using a dry powder device, the only way you get the drug into your lungs is by generating a good inspiratory flow rate. And this was a much smaller study in just 7 patients looking at the inspiratory flow rates that were generated with the breathe-haler and the hand-haler, showing patients could breathe in more easily through the breathe-haler device. And indeed, some studies where you ask about patient preference say they prefer to use the breathe-haler to the hand-haler. So, in terms of comparison with tiotropium, in the best sort of blinded way you're ever going to be able to do it, equally efficacious in terms of TRUF FEV1 at the end of the study, SGRQ, TDI, but crucially, an advantage for glycopyrrolium in terms of its speed of onset, and we've already seen a fast speed of onset in terms of producing exercise improvements as well, and possibly an easier device to use. Finally, because increasingly many of us are now using both LABA and LAMA, either in separate inhalers or increasingly in combination inhalers, what is the evidence that if you add glycopyrrolium to a LABA, you will get additive benefit, which is what you would expect? And this has been looked at in the GLOW-6 study. And I think it's important to remember that when we give a LABA as well as a LABA, or this is the way the study was done, again, it was a 12-week study, all patients received indacaterol on Breeze in the Breeze inhaler for 12 weeks, but then in a double-blind fashion, they then had a second Breeze inhaler, which either contained active glycopyrrolium or placebo. So you were comparing indacaterol monotherapy with indacaterol plus glycopyrrolium combination therapy, albeit in two separate inhalers. I think it's worth reminding ourselves why we expect a LABA and a LAMA to have an additive effect. Clearly, they work in entirely different pharmacological ways, so on purely pharmacological principles, you'd expect to see some additive effect. And I think also where we look at where all of the receptors are in the lung, we know that the majority of muscarinic receptors are in the large airways, and beta receptors are throughout the lung and in lung tissue as well. So by giving both together, it's more likely you're going to stimulate more receptors and perhaps get an additive effect. These are the patients that were put in the study, and looking at the results, and here the orange is the combination therapy of glycopyrrolium plus indacaterol compared with indacaterol alone. And you can see both at day 1 and at the end of week 12, looking at the trough FEV1, you've got that extra improvement that you would theoretically have expected to see. This looks at symptoms. Again, our patients aren't interested in FEV1. Patients are interested in symptoms. And this shows both for the duo therapy, the combination therapy, compared with monotherapy, the change in an overall symptom score, a better improvement in symptom score with two drugs rather than one, and looking at how active patients are and what they are able to do. Again, patients on the two drugs rather than one have more activity and are able to do the activities of normal everyday living. So again, clearly what you would expect, two drugs better than one. And finally, this is just looking at breathlessness, again looking at TDI. This shows the improvement in TDI, two drugs versus one. And this is looking at the percentage of patients who get this magical improvement in TDI of at least 1 point, which is thought to be what is clinically significant. So again, clear advantage for the combination therapy. So you'll be delighted to know I'm now at the end of this list. And I hope I've convinced you that all these ticks are justified. That with glycopyrrolium, we now have a really exciting new once-daily LABA therapy. It's pharmacologically different from tiotropium. In terms of lung function, it's doing all the things you would expect with the added benefit of a fast onset of action, which may be crucially important for all those early morning symptoms. It produces the improvement in symptoms that our patients are concerned about. It is safe. If you actually do proper exercise testing, even after the very first dose, you're getting improvements in endurance time, less breathlessness, and improvements in spiritual capacity. Compared with tiotropium, it is at least as good as, if not better than tiotropium, with the advantage of fast onset of action and an inhalation device that some patients find easier to use. And again, and we'll be hearing a lot more about this over the next year or two, you get an added benefit for patients who are already on LABA therapy. So I hope I've convinced you that I've covered all the points I said I would cover at the beginning, and that you will agree that so far this is a job well done. So, if we go back to this diagram that I showed right at the very beginning, if you believe in the gold strategy, we can have an argument about that if you like, but if you believe in the gold strategy, we know that LAMA therapy is indicated as first-line or second-line treatment for virtually all patients. Up until now, LAMA has been synonymous with tiotropium, but as from today onwards, we now have, I think, an exciting new alternative LAMA therapy with glycopyrrolium. So my very, very last slide, which I always like to show whenever I, from the UK, it was cold and raining when I left. I always like coming somewhere where the sun is shining. Though we always seem to have meetings in subterranean rooms where you can never see the sun during the day. But I like to compare sunrise with COPD for the following reason. I've been looking after patients with COPD for nearly 30 years now. And for a long time, there was a very nihilistic attitude to COPD. There's nothing we can do to help you. It's your fault because you smoke cigarettes. Or here, I suppose, because you smoke shisha. And there was a very, very negative attitude to COPD. Well, I like to think that we now have a new dawn for COPD management. I think I tell my patients, there's never been a better time to have COPD, because there's now so much we can do to help you. And crucially, after today, I think it's really exciting in that we now have once-daily glycopyrrolium as an exciting new alternative for LAMA therapy in patients with COPD. Thank you all very much for your attention.
Thank you.